May it please the court, Matthew Coleman on behalf of the appellant Chad Allen Scott. Today I would like to focus the court on three main issues why this court should reverse the district court.
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear it? Okay, Judge King?
Yeah, this is perfect. Thank you.
All right, sir.
Proceed, Your Honor.
Yes.
Again, I'd like to focus on three issues why this court should reverse the district court. First, errors regarding counts one and two, the violations alleging United States Code Title 18, 15, 19 regarding the alleged falsification of DEA reports with the intent to obstruct, impede the proper administration of justice. Two, error at sentencing, both in the application of a 16-level cross-reference as well as an additional four-level enhancement on top of the cross-reference. And three, error regarding a biased juror who is known as juror number 27. First, the district court committed reversible error when it prohibited the defense from referencing multiple venues available for administrative forfeiture. In this case, it was first tried in January of 2019. In that case, the district court held counts one through seven. The other counts were severed at a later trial. In that trial in January of 2019, the district court allowed the defense to both cross-examine government witnesses as well as present our own witnesses that reference the multiple venues that are available for administrative forfeitures under the federal law. As the court knows from the record, that trial ended in a hung jury, a deadlocked jury. The court declared a mistrial. After the first trial, but shortly before the second trial, which took place in August of 2019, the district court on its own raised the issue concerning the defendant's use and presentation of multiple statutes regarding administrative forfeiture. There was briefing held on the first day of trial. The district court issued a written ruling where the district court excluded any reference to and prohibited defense from using any reference to any other administrative forfeiture statute, both in cross-examination of the government's witness, Vicky Rashid, who is DEA counsel, as well as through our own expert witness. Under Montana v. Egelhoff, 1996, obviously a defendant is allowed the right to present a complete defense. When the district court excluded that evidence and prohibited the defense from presenting any evidence regarding the other statutes or the other avenues and venues that are available for administrative forfeiture, the defendant's constitutional rights were impugned. For instance, what the district court did not even touch and address in their ruling where the district court excluded and prohibited the defense from using 28 U.S.C. 1355. In that statute provides for forfeiture actions or proceedings, which this was, to take place in any district where any of the acts or omissions giving rise to the forfeiture occurred. Here, the defendant and property was found in Houston, Texas, Southern District of Texas. The investigation, the Michelli investigation, was an Eastern District of Louisiana investigation. Multiple defendants were prosecuted, pled guilty, went to trial in the Eastern District.
Are you talking about the truck?
Yes, ma'am, the truck.
All right. I thought there was also evidence that he had told this drug dealer to go out and get a new truck, and then he forfeited it before any proceedings had been brought at all.
The record shows part of that to be correct, Your Honor. What actually occurred was Frederick Brown, the drug dealer who was a cooperator at that time, had purchased the truck with the drug proceeds that he had. Agent Scott said, as part of your cooperation, you need to forfeit assets that you had derived from drug trafficking. That's what Agent Scott did. That's what Frederick Brown turned in. He also forfeited a truck and some cash, a Rolex watch and some cash as well. But he was not charged with any extortion or anything along those lines. He was simply charged with 1519 obstruction or falsification of records, which obstructed some proper administration of justice. The government's theory at trial was the forfeiture should have taken place in one place only, the Southern District of Texas, Houston, that it was impossible and illegal and was improper to the administration of justice to take place in this district, in the Eastern District of Louisiana, where the underlying acts occurred.
But the point is, he confiscated the truck, brought it back to Louisiana before proceedings of any sort had occurred, right?
No, not the investigation, the Michelle investigation had taken place years earlier and was ongoing. And so, in fact, in the DEA reports themselves, it says Michelle investigation with the New Orleans Field Department, Field Division number from the DEA in Metairie. He didn't actually confiscate the truck. It was a voluntary forfeiture. So it was actually provided by Frederick Brown. The only difference is between Houston and New Orleans is that Chad Scott drove it back here. That's it. Prong two, element two, under the 1519 allegations in counts one and two, specifically require the government to prove that there was an obstruction, an influence, and an investigation was impeded. That's where the government's facts fall apart. We also have an insufficiency argument that we offered on the brief, and I won't touch upon that too much, but there, the Vicki Rashid, the DEA's counsel, said, all you need for administrative forfeiture is probable cause, proper notice, and publication. All three took place here. She admitted that on the stand. All three took place. It was probable cause, there was proper notice to Frederick Brown at his address in Houston, and there was publication throughout the United States. All three took place, and as she said, you're good to go at that point. So that's the insufficiency argument, Judge. But we were hamstrung and prohibited from showing a complete defense when we've got federal statutes that provide for a different venue and provide for the venue wherever the underlying acts occurred. And that's what the jury never heard. It also violated the law of the case doctrine, as we cited to the court, where it is error for a district court to reverse itself on an identical evidentiary ruling made during the first trial, barring clear error or a change in circumstances. There were no change in circumstances whatsoever.
I think a district court, since when does law of the case bar a district court like that?
That's what the Tham decision came up with in the Ninth Circuit, which relied upon White versus Murtha, which is a Fifth Circuit case. It can change if there's a change in circumstances or...
Can't the district court decide maybe he or she ruled in error?
They can. They have to say that they ruled in clear error. Here, all the district court said was it's irrelevant, misleading, and confusing. All it did was it was our actual defense to prong two, element two of the offense. There was nothing confusing about it whatsoever. It was an alternate theory on what could have happened. So there was no improper administration of justice. It's not just that a person can put a typo intentionally or an oversight, and then that becomes a federal crime under 1519. The government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was something that was obstructed, the proper administration of justice or some investigation. There was no such improper administration of justice because it could have been brought here, as it was brought here. And we were prevented from showing that to the jury at that trial. Next, if I can move on to the second issue, the district court erred in sentencing when it applied a six-level reference under 2J1.3C1, where the district court sentenced the DEA agent, Appellant Scott, referencing Jorge Peralta's heroin trafficking guidelines and literally adopted his guidelines under 2J1.3, which took his base offense level from a 14, added 16 on top of it, and then the district court added another four levels that I'll get to briefly. In order to cross-reference under 2J1.3, the perjury must be in respect to a criminal offense. Not in respect to a criminal trial, not in respect to a criminal proceeding. There is a separate guideline under that same section or subsection that holds that if the perjury resulted in substantial interference with the administration of justice, increased by three levels. As the guideline lays out in application note number one, substantial interference with the administration of justice includes a premature or improper termination of a felony investigation, an indictment, verdict, or any judicial determination based upon perjury, false testimony, or other false evidence, or the unnecessary expenditure of substantial government or court resources. That's what occurred here. That's what the charges were in the indictment of counts 3 through 7. That's what the government's theory was. It was not that Agent Scott was helping a defendant avoid responsibility. It was that he interfered with the substantial. Strike that. He interfered with the criminal trial, and it led to a premature investigation, a premature conviction, and that was based on false testimony. That's what the conduct lays out. That's where it is, substantial interference. The cross-reference has to be in respect to the criminal offense. And as this court has found in Martinez in 1997, that has to be very entwined and enmeshed with the offense itself. So once you look at the offense then, under the strict definition in the guidelines itself, it includes offense means the offense of conviction or relevant conduct under 1B1.3. Relevant conduct includes the case of jointly undertaken criminal activity. It includes all acts and omissions of others that occurred during the commission of the offense in preparation for that offense.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. I mean, this is an interesting application of this guideline, to be sure. It's sort of counterintuitive. But at the same time, didn't the judge expressly say that she would have given Scott the same sentence regardless?
She gave that one conclusory sentence, Judge. She did not calculate.
We've been asking district judges to give that one conclusory sentence for some years now because of these very complications in the guidelines, and I'm not sure why we shouldn't say that that overrides any potential error here.
Because to satisfy that heavy burden that the government would have under harmless error, it has to convincingly prove that the incorrect guideline had no influence whatsoever over the ultimate sentence. The district court here did not calculate that correct guideline range. All the district court said was, even if I don't use this guideline, the 16 levels, from a 14 to, you know, now basically a 36 at the end of the day, which went from 37 to 46 months to 188 to 235, I'd still give him the 160 months. That would still be my sentence. That's all she said. That's all she said. There was, on top of that, Judge, as far as harmless error, and the government concedes this in their brief, as far as the four levels. So once the 16 level was adopted, okay, and I'm backing up a little bit. Once it was adopted, under 1B1.5C, I believe it is, then that reference range becomes the actual guideline. And any Chapter 3 adjustments as far as leadership or abuse of trust must be based on that new guideline. You can't have it both ways.
Well, what's your best case for saying that we disregard the district court's statement that she would have sentenced him to this? I mean, the facts here from the standpoint of the apparent perversion of the justice system are pretty grotesque. So what is the, how can we disregard what the district court said? We don't want to... You know, you can go back on resentencing, and she's still well within the statutory maximum.
She still has to, obviously, under Gall and Alfaro, she has to correctly calculate the guideline range. She did not. The district court did not correctly calculate the guideline range. It did not say, if I did not give this particular sentence, the guideline range would be X. On top of that, on the four levels, as you see from the brief, the two levels for leadership, two levels for abuse of trust, which must be based on the new, on the heroin guidelines. Instead, as the PSR lays out and as the district court said, he was a leader in the perjury, he abused trust in the perjury. That's what she based that on. That is a strict violation of 1B1.5. Chapter 3 adjustments, once you then cross-reference, you're now in the heroin guideline range, 2D1.1, you can be a leader in that, but you have to be a leader in the drugs. You can be in abuse trust, but you have to abuse trust in the drugs. The district court did not address that whatsoever. In fact, when the district court was giving the sentence and denied the 16-level cross-reference, I had to raise my hand and interrupt her and say, Judge, we had another objection. Two levels for leadership, two levels for abuse of trust. District court said, I believe he got a bit confused. District court said, and this is in the transcript itself, I considered that objection and I overruled it yesterday because we had a two-day sentence. The district court did not overrule it the day before. The district court never did, at a minimum, at that instance, say, even if I don't give these four levels, I would still give the 160-month sentence. The government says, well, we should get harmless error and it should extend from the 16-level cross-reference, improper cross-reference, then you should extend it to the four-level cross-reference. The district court never considered that, never came up with a correct guideline range whatsoever. So on that alone, on those four levels, harmless error is non-existent.
How much of a difference did the four levels make?
It would have made it 3 years at a minimum in that range. I mean, obviously, district court has discretion, but we'll never know at this point. And Judge, that's the same instance, the same exact scenario that came place and that we cite to the court in United States versus Carr. And I'll quote it if I could, under section 1B1.5C, the abuse of trust adjustments must therefore, in the case of a cross-reference, be applied with respect to the reference offense and not the offense of conviction. I see my time is dwindling down. If I could squeeze in a few moments about the last issue, the co-defendant's juror number 27. District court committed reversible error when it not only denied the motion for a new trial filed by Rodney Gemar, Chad Scott's co-defendant, but she also refused to have a hearing.
Well, of course, it wasn't your client. It was the co-defendant, number one. Number two, it was a high school friend, apparently a Facebook friend or something. Number three, why is that prejudicial against your client as opposed to possibly being in favor?
Well, I'll start with the last one if I could. You've got charged co-defendants, charged conspirators, two defendants, the only two in the court, that were alleged to have been partners for years, thick as thieves, so to speak. That's what the government's evidence is. So any prejudice to him, to Rodney Gemar, having juror number 27 sit on that panel.
But my point is, normally, I would think normally a defendant would be thrilled to have a friendly person from way back on the jury.
Well, I'll say this, as being an old trial judge myself, I would never want my co-defendant's wife's ex-boyfriend sitting in judgment on me. That is a guarantee, Judge. That is a guarantee. But most importantly, what happened here is we don't know what the ramifications were. We know that juror number 27 raised his hand and said, I do have an issue with police. I was arrested several years ago. I didn't like the way I was treated. So he knew how to raise his hand. He knew how to speak. When the district court said the defendants are Chad Scott and Rodney Gemar, does anybody know them or any of their family members? Juror number 27 didn't say a word. Did not say a word. It's not just that they'd been Facebook friends, Judge. He'd actually, and Judge King was on the same panel, this is before the court right now, and Rodney Gemar's oral argument that took place in February. He actually went to Rodney Gemar's wedding. Didn't raise his hand. Went to and dated the defendant's wife. Never raised his hand. Saw her in court, I'm presuming, because she was there after jury selection for the next 10, 11 days. Never raised his hand whatsoever.
That means juror 27 is actually biased against.
Yes.
What is the theory of that?
Well, one, it was a material question that he didn't ask.
Yeah, but how
to answer honestly.
Explain to me in plain language how that relationship means the juror is actually biased against your client.
Well, it's just two prongs, Judge. Once he lies about it or omits the truth about it, and two, if it's a valid basis for a challenge for cause. Valid basis. The district court, when it denied the motion for a new trial, said, well, I wouldn't have granted the challenge for cause anyway. That flies in the face, and we briefed this. Juror number 34, the government challenged for cause because juror number 34 knew of a government witness. The government challenged for cause. The district court granted that challenge for cause. Now we have a much more egregious scenario where you've got an actual juror who knows and dated co-defendant's wife.
People have all sorts of relationships, and the law circumscribes certain relationships and says, well, those could show actual bias, and we know what those are. This isn't one of those. This is a more distant relationship. So I just don't understand how it shows actual bias.
Well, when he lies about it, that's the omission. That's prong one. If he had raised his hand and said, you know, I've got this relationship, the district court would have had that opportunity to ferret that out. District court did not have that opportunity.
Well, so I don't know anything about the other case, but suppose the other case granted relief on that, what would that mean for this case?
Same relief, Judge. Same relief. We cited cases too, and I believe it's United States versus Gray, Fifth Circuit, that when all defendants suffer from the same error, that any arguments and any issues raised goes to that same defendant's relief, Judge. And in fact, one of the main things that came up in the oral argument, I won't speak for Judge King, obviously, but this came up, was the district court's denial of the even hearing. And under United States versus Phillips, 1982 Supreme Court held that the remedy for allegations of juror partiality is a hearing in which defendant has the opportunity to prove actual bias.
Okay, well, you've gone way over your
time. Yes, ma'am.
Here, but that's okay. You also have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Lieberman.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Yes, sir.
Dave Lieberman from the United States. If I could just start with the juror bias issue where Mr. Komen left off. There's a critical distinction between this case and co-defendant Gamar's case in that Mr. Scott never raised a juror bias claim below. So we're here on plain error. And irrespective of what happens in the co-defendant case, Mr. Scott has to run through the four prongs. And he, on this record, cannot do so. He has not shown any implied bias, some of the categories that Judge Duncan, you were referencing earlier. He's not the juror 27 was not connected to the prosecution agency, not involved in the crime. And there's nothing in the record showing that juror 27 was actually biased against Mr. Scott. The fact that a juror provides incorrect or false information during voir dire is not in and of itself a basis for a new trial on this claim.
Well, just for the sake of argument, I know that I'm pretty confident that the trial went forward against these both of these fellows and showed them hand in glove in doing the same kind of activity or aiding and abetting each other in a precisely the same activity. So it would seem to me that if the juror gets kicked off from one co-defendant, that automatically leads to a question about the other one.
So a couple of responses, Your Honor.
I haven't seen this circumstance before, and if you can cite a case, it would help.
So I have not seen this circumstance either. I can only cite the general standard that defendants must raise to get post-trial relief on a juror bias claim. And it's not just the juror provided false information during voir dire. It's that this court and the Supreme Court have said that motives for concealing information vary, and so the defendant post-trial must connect the non-disclosed information to the fairness and integrity of the trial. And I don't think the record here does that, particularly on plain error review. The co-defendant, Mr. Gamar, had preserved this claim below. And so under plain error review, under those four prongs, the lack of a record here.
Well, just again, for the sake of argument, if the other, and I know nothing about it, nothing about it, but if the other panel decided that this juror was biased or that the court erred by not holding a hearing, surely that would go to the benefit of both defendants. You don't keep one in prison when there's a biased jury when the other one gets a new trial, do you?
It would depend on the nature of if the district court were to find, if there Mr. Gamar's case has not been decided, but if there was a remand and if the juror found actual bias, it would depend, I think, on the nature of the district court's finding. It's, would the bias hit both defendants or just Mr. Gamar? And I should point out that this is something that we stressed in our brief, is that this jury acquitted Scott of a charge on count 10. And so running through the prongs of plain error, particularly on the third prong, the fact that this jury found Mr. Scott not guilty on one of the counts in the joint trial really undercuts the claim that there was plain error in the district court's handling of this issue below. Final point, these claims only relate to, of course, the joint trial, the standalone trial with the perjury, falsification, and obstruction offenses would obviously not be affected by the juror bias claim. If I could turn to this second trial claim, the district court's exclusion of references to 21 U.S.C. 881J at the second trial. The district court did not abuse its discretion because the district court found, as a matter of law, that the statute did not apply in this case. The text of the statute is pretty, we have a sort of base background forfeiture rule that proceedings for forfeiture are brought where the property is found. Title 21 provides an additional venue rule providing for venue in Title 21 drug seizures or related to Title 21 prosecutions. In addition to that other venue provision, it may be brought in a proceeding for forfeiture under this section may be brought in the judicial district in which the defendant owning such property is found, or the judicial district in which the criminal prosecution is brought. And the district court correctly noted, I think Judge Jones, your question mentioned this earlier, the sequencing of this. The seizure of the truck and the administrative forfeiture of the truck occurred before Mr. Brown was a defendant in a federal criminal proceeding. So this statute, as a matter of law, is not applicable. The presentation this morning focused on how defense counsel might have used the statute at trial, but this is a question of law that I'm having trouble thinking how we would ever submit to the jury what Section 881J means and which and how it operates. And so, because the district court said this statute is just not applicable under the facts of this case, by definition, did not abuse its discretion in excluding it. The defense theory this morning is basically that the statute authorized forfeiture of the truck in the Eastern District of Louisiana. Therefore, as a matter of law, I cannot be convicted of falsification of government records because all the falsities didn't affect any administration of justice. And the district court just kicks out that theory from the front end and just says, your reading of the statute is wrong. And the presentation this morning has not cited any case or any other saying that 881J operates differently from what the district court construed it as. Mr. Komen also brought up law of the case. It's black letter law, as I understand it in this district, that the law of the case doctrine does not prevent a district court from reconsidering its prior rulings. This is why parties often file motions for reconsiderations before district court. Procedurally, the law of the case argument was also raised for the first time in the reply brief at page 11, so it's abandoned. But if the court would like a citation to my proposition of law that I just cited, it's the Zarnow case, 614 F3rd 161 at Penn site 171. Unless there are any additional questions on the trial side, I'll go to the sentencing claims. And clear, the government views the district court's guidelines errors as a proper application of the guidelines, but this court, if it does not want to, does not have to reach any of those issues, because even if the district court committed procedural error on the cross-reference or the abuse of trust and leadership enhancements, it was harmless because the district court did what this court has often invited district courts to do. At the end of a two-day sentencing hearing, the court says, even if I had granted the objection to the obstruction cross-reference, and that was a plus 16, I would have imposed the same sentence.
What's the consequence of a plus 16 here?
So the plus 16, so the defense recommended range on my notes was 37 to 46. And then with the cross-reference in the other grouping rules, the district judge calculated 188 to 235.
Right. I mean, it's a huge difference in the potential sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the district court recognized that, but then she says, this is that record, ROA 8549, the court finds that the seriousness of this offense warrants nothing less than 160 months. And then the court, it's not a conclusory sentence. The district court continues to walk through why it made that alternative finding. It found that Scott caused, quote, significant and far-reaching damage to the administration of justice in the Eastern District of Louisiana. The court noted that multiple criminal cases from that district had to be dismissed in light of the conduct discovered in this case. The government was also forced to drastically reduce its charges in many other criminal cases. The court further noted that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Louisiana was forced to recuse itself from a number of cases and investigations. And finally, the district court cited the need for law enforcement officers to diligently follow the law. And in this setting, where a guidelines issue is hotly disputed and a district court rules against the defendant, overrules the objection, but says very clearly, I would have independently imposed this term under the 3553A factors. This court usually, quote, takes the district court at its clear and plain word. There's no reason for this court to deviate from that custom in this case, again, in light of the district court's clear familiarity with the record. It presided over three criminal trials.
But you do acknowledge that this is a very bizarre application of that 2J1 whatever.
It is definitely unique. I have not found it.
Why didn't the government concede that to begin with? Why didn't the government concede that misapplication to begin with?
So I don't know. We think the district court got it right. I started off with a harmless error just because if the court doesn't want to deal with figuring out how the cross-reference operates, it could just say the district court independently tethered its sentence to the 3553A factors. But I'll happily go there. The district court correctly interpreted the cross-reference. The cross-reference says if the offense involved perjury in respect to a criminal offense, apply this cross-reference. Mr. Scott, the jury found that Mr. Scott committed perjury, and it was in respect to a criminal offense. The subject of his perjury was implicating Jorge Peralta in federal drug trafficking activity. And so we think we have it on the plain language. And the district court's position is also well supported by the purpose of this cross-reference. And we cited to several neighboring circuits which have recognized that the purpose of this cross-reference is to address perjuries that have the potential to disrupt the investigation or prosecution of the criminal offense at issue. And Mr. Scott's perjury in this case plainly disrupted the government's effort to try Mr. Peralta, to convict Mr. Peralta of serious drug trafficking charges. So it falls plain text and purpose. The last thing that I wanted to point out in my affirmative presentation is the district court noted that under Mr. Scott's presentation, we would have to attribute an intent to the commission to slice different perjuries differently or punish different perjuries differently. So that a perjury that falsely seeks to get somebody, exonerate somebody for a criminal offense, that person under Mr. Scott's reading gets the enhancement. But a perjury that falsely accuses somebody or falsely implicates somebody in a criminal offense, under Mr. Scott's view, that person should be punished, doesn't get this cross-reference. And it's hard, at least for me standing here, to envision a world where the Sentencing Commission wanted to distinguish levels of culpability in perjuries that falsely accuse versus perjuries that falsely exonerate. In response to some of Mr. Komen's points on Martinez, the court in Martinez when it said the perjury there was enmeshed and entwined with the perjury offense, criminal offense, the court was just quoting a district court statement. The court was not interpreting the cross-reference. We think the language of in respect to is both broad and straightforward and also applies here. Mr. Komen also referenced that there's a separate provision in the perjury guideline about administration of justice and somehow suggests that, well, because that one applies, the cross-reference couldn't apply. The commission, however, in the cross-reference itself, understood that these provisions would operate in tandem because it directs sentencing courts to just apply whichever base offense level is greater. And so that procedure is, by definition, sort of commission understanding that these and other provisions in the perjury offense work in tandem, and the district court is to run the calculations and then take whichever one is greater. I'd also like to, unless there are any additional questions on the perjury side, I'd like to briefly address the organizer leader and abuse of trust enhancements. So the district court found that these applied. There's no challenge to the factual record underlying that. It's just Mr. Scott claims that these enhancements were off the table as a matter of law. We think the best case on our side is the Carr case, which we cited. It is unpublished, but we think its reasoning is persuasive from this circuit, which is where a district court applies the cross-reference, the guidelines instruct the district court to tether any Chapter 3 adjustments to the cross-reference guideline. That's what happened in Carr. In Carr, the district court used a cross-reference, 2D1.1, the drug quantity table, and then it also applied an abuse of trust enhancement under Chapter 3, just like below here. And this court said, because the cross-reference doesn't say anything about Chapter 3 enhancements, because the offense level under 2D1.1 does not take into account an abuse of trust, the district court correctly applied the abuse of trust enhancement. Same posture here. The cross-reference provision, it's 2X3.1, is silent on any Chapter 3 enhancements. Doesn't say anything, doesn't seek to constrain them, doesn't direct district courts how to apply them under that particular provision. As a result, the district court was free as a matter of law to apply these additional enhancements. The court did. That's completely consistent with this court's decision in Carr. And we also noted an 11th Circuit decision, Brenson, where the panel confronted a similar fact pattern and affirmed an abuse of trust enhancement off of a cross-reference guideline. So for all these reasons, we think the district court here correctly construed both of these guidelines provisions. There was no procedural error to begin with, but for the reasons that I started with at the beginning, even if there was procedural error, in light of the district court's alternative ruling tethering the 160-month term to the 3553A factors, anywhere error was harmless.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that the court affirm. Yep.
All right, Mr. Common, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Let's start, if I could, very briefly and touch upon the standard review for juror number 27. Counsel's correct. We did not file a motion for a new trial. We were already here. Chad Scott was sentenced on August 12th. His notice of appeal was filed on August 16th. Trial counsel withdrew and granted by the district court August 18th. Rodney Guimar files his motion for a new trial August 27th. So under Rule 51, preserving claimed error, this is B, if a party does not have an opportunity to object to a ruling or order, the absence of an objection does not later prejudice that party. So there, we did not have an opportunity.
What rule was that?
51B, Your Honor, okay. Preservation of error.
Right.
In fact, when you look to Rule 33, the motion for new trial itself, it actually states that district court doesn't even have jurisdiction and cannot rule upon a motion for new trial if the matter is before Your Honors, which this one is. So it wasn't like we stood silent. We were already here, so it was too late. Back on the sentencing, Judge, if I could start with the two-level enhancements, the Chapter 3s, the 1B1.5C violations. And, Judge, this is at Record on Appeal 8547. When the district court starts to, and the district court states, having ruled on the objections, the court adopts and recommends the findings of fact contained in the pre-sentence report. I then have to interrupt the court and say, Judge, the court has never ruled upon the trust two-level enhancement and the leadership role enhancement, which was assessed on the perjury as opposed to the cross-reference itself. And the court states at 8548, I understand, I looked at that objection yesterday and the cross-reference applies the base calculation to the charge, which is perjury here. I calculated the two and overruled the objection. That's not what the objection was. The court never did overrule the objection when the district court went through the pre-sentence report itself. And then when I raised that, on top of the 16-level increase, where we go from 14 to a 30, plus the 4 plus another grouping of 2, we're at a 36, the court confused that with the cross-reference. So the court this court should not look upon this particular sentence as being available to harmless error review because the court did not even calculate the correct guideline range on either one and didn't even touch it on the four. So that's not even close. As far as the substance itself, 1B1.5, and obviously we cited the court to the Carr case, as well as the 11th Circuit decision, Salgado, from 2014, which specifically states as to section 1B1.5C, that provision means that where a guideline determines a defendant's offense level by reference to another offense, the Chapter 3 adjustments are to be based on the guideline and rules for that other offense, meaning the heroin trafficking. It's possible, but that's not what she did here. So for those reasons, we'd ask the district court rulings, conviction, and sentence to be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.